so fundamentally or by its nature completely open, undefined. But then once mind starts to define, it starts to get wrapped up in its definitions and then can get stuck in them, essentially.
The dualistic thing is that since you split into subject and object, when you look at an object, and that's anything, what comes with that are three basic reactions of passion, aggression, or ignorance. You either you look at that object and it seems attractive, so you try to possess it. You look at it, it seems unattractive, and you try to reject it. Or you figure that it has no relation to yourself. So that is the base instinct of a subjective mind. It's constantly grabbing at things, pushing things away, and ignoring things. And that's how the world gets very complicated in terms of living within an interpretation of it, because you habituate. You decide, I like this color, but I hate that color. And so then you replicate the reactions every time or tend to.
Okay, but that's after dualism is established. One
yes.
fundamental question I have is that I don't think the West has much of anything to say about. So I'm wondering what the Buddhists would say. Why didn't the mind just wake up and bask in the glory of its creative powers and its luminosity and the display? Why did it make this move to say, I'm in here and the world's out there, and it's like it got scared of itself or something? Why did that even happen?
The descriptions of that are interesting. They don't exactly explain the essential thing. But and this is maybe a little vague, but there's a sense of that luminous quality of cognizing. It kind of loses its balance. It kind of panics. It kind of panics in the space and doesn't know, what do I do next? What am I doing here? There's this kind of an instinct to pull in and hold. And that's the base instinct that happens before everything else. There's a level of panic, a sense of this here and that over there. And okay, now I have a sense of how to proceed, and how I proceed is that over there. I like it or I don't like it or I don't care, and that helps reinforce the sense of me at the base of it. And then there's some ideas. You start to label it, I love red, but I hate brown, or whatever it is. You start to plaster the labels on it, and hence it starts to develop some level of story. And then you're in the story of me.
You're off to the races.
And back at the beginning, there's a sense of panic about the open space.
It's too much. There's too much power.
Yeah. Yep. And the luminosity quality is this vast splendor, the brilliance of phenomena. There's no end to it, and
millions
that becomes
colors.
Overwhelming.
Yes, millions of colors, millions of infinite number of shapes.
Yeah. So you if you just relax and let go, you lose that sense of me. And it stops being divided. But there's fear now about it. And so the fear is assuaged by holding on and establishing some artificial relationship to it. And then, but the problem is you have to maintain it because it keeps falling apart. So you keep recreating it. and the recreation becomes habitual, and we become deeply convinced of this habit.
But what does habituation effectively assuage that fear? Because habituation is essentially starting to limit the degrees of freedom in the system, right? Like, it's like,
yep.
I don't actually have, I'm stuck in these patterns. I don't actually have the freedom that I really do, but I don't have it anymore. And that's comfortable on some level,
question mark,
right? That's effectively comfortable because it's saving us from the fear of, I mean, that's a lot of psychology, right? There's comfort in victimhood because I have someone to blame.
Yeah.
And I have, right? There's a lot of comfort in victimhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
because I know who I am. I'm the victim.
Therefore,
right. I'm secured by the victimhood. That's as egotistical as the perpetrator of the, you know, the harm.
Yes, and it's all very predictable, which is what the brain, right? The brain is producing or contributing to the production of this reality, and it's doing so because the brain has been shaped by evolution. It's basically trying to predict what's coming next. Like, I drank water, I'm not going to die of thirst, so I can take out, the brain takes away and the mind takes away the feeling of thirst. And so in the past, if the mind couldn't predict what was going to happen next, it got killed. And so we need to be able to predict what's next. And if I allow change or openness, flexibility, then I increasingly don't know what's going to happen next. Because, like, if I fundamentally change my personality, I don't know how people are going to react to me. I don't know how I'm going to drive, if I train in certain things. And so I get scared of that. And my response to that then is not changing is safety. Because according to evolution, unpredictability implies death. And change implies unpredictability. So just by logic and reason, for our mind and our brain especially, change equals death, which is one of the reasons I believe change is so difficult for humans. It's a really crappy homeostasis is still safer and feels better on some level than changing. It's why people, I think it's a big reason people stay in bad relationships. They stay depressed. Because their mind is fundamentally terrified of altering that reality, because it doesn't know. Like, if I weren't suffering, what am I going to talk about with my friends? How am I going to, what am I going to do all day if I'm not working to alleviate my suffering and trying to create conditions where I don't feel my suffering? I have no idea how to be in that reality. So I'll just stay suffering. At least I know what it is. I know what to do when I wake up tomorrow. It's all very comfortable. It's crappy, but it's comfortable. It's like comfortably uncomfortable.
But I wonder. I wonder if that's necessarily, you know, that there's that's an explanation of a mechanical determinism with the brain. And I wonder the brain is got habituated that way, but could habituate it some other way. Why not? Well, you could understand, you go back trying to imagine something like cavemen in the Stone Age and all of that. Well, hey, they were living in a dangerous, unpredictable world, but I wonder if they were quite so habitual about how they related to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that gets back to, you just reminded me of Dr. Carol Dweck has made a very nice career out of talking about the fixed versus growth mindset. And how the fixed mindset is a great way to ruin a perfectly good life. and she advocates for the establishment of a growth mindset that is ready to accept its ability to change its experience and its reality and its all of it. And so it's like you're talking about a kind of extreme version of that. Can the mind return, is what I'm understanding you saying, like, is it possible for the mind to return back to its fundamental capability as the all-creating sovereign? Sure, but I still think there's one thing that needs to be removed from the system slowly, and that's fear, right? Because isn't fear driving the whole thing? You just said that's what started it, and that's what's still running it.
Yeah.
Right? So it's all fundamentally anxiety.
Well, fear of change, I guess. Your the sense of self, the sense of ego, is that it's trying to establish its continuity, and that's there are constant threats to its continuity because everything is in a state of change all the time.
What do you mean by that? It's trying to establish continuity and maintain it.
Well, because things are in a constant state of change, at least subtly, then the quality of continuity is threatened, right? Suppose you're, very proud person and someone comes along and points out something really stupid you did. Well, it's hard to maintain the pride if you're stupid.
Yes, there's no continuity. You just broke continuity of pride.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it could be a complete opposite. You're always doing stupid things, but you did something smart, and somebody said you did something smart.
Right.
Or you even recognize you did something smart, but now you've got this identity, identity rests in continuity. You have to continue the sense of who you are. But in fact, everything's shifting all the time. You're stupid about some things. You're proud about others. You're this way with that and that way with this. You wake up into a world where you're constantly shifting around in relationships, and the change is there anyway. And so there's some fear. There's an automatic fear that the ego has that is existential insecurity. It has all the time, pretty much, or pretty close.
Okay, but you just used a term there that we haven't really talked about, this ego thing. So
yeah, so that's the subjective self that seems, bounded and continuous and dualistically views the rest of the world as external to itself.
Right, and as I understand it, the problem, there's an ego function, right, in the mind. And because, people experience the ultimate, and then it's almost like they don't come back from it. They start saying kind of dumb things like, we're all one. It's like, well, yeah, on some level, but if we were all one, you could tell me what I'm thinking, but you can't. And you eating doesn't help my body. So I actually do need to eat. And so there's an ego function that keeps this being alive and running and says, I do need to eat and deal with my own thoughts.
Oh, maybe you just call it intelligence.
Okay. But the problem is, I think, as I understand it, when the mind becomes identified with the ego function, it says, I am that separate thing.
Yeah.
Then you have all the basis for suffering. I am the victim.
Oh, you're now starting up the huge drama of being me.
Of being me. But that's fundamentally what happened and is the basis of all suffering, is mind starts out as this creative process. It kind of freaks out about that a little bit. There's an ego function that eventually forms out of that fear, and it's almost like it just gets wrapped around the axle from that point on, because fear is the basis of that thing. And the only way to see things any other way is to then relax that fear. And then what will happen there is the mind no longer feels the need to identify with that function. The function will still run in the brain, but that's not a problem, right? Fundamentally, it's just once the mind identifies with it and says, that's me, I am this separate thing.
No, it has to maintain its separateness. That's why there's fear. The fundamental insecurity comes because the constant effort to maintain the separateness, clear boundaries of me.
While things continue to incessantly affect me.
Actually, you're in this unending fabric of change, birth and death. I mean, let's say your alarm goes off in the morning, you open your eyes, and then something ensues. Either you're thinking, oh, I don't want to get out of bed, or maybe you're a morning person, I am not. Maybe you leap out of bed, hello, good morning, it's the day is here. Yeah. And then you go to the bathroom to brush your teeth, to take a shower. Now you're in some other place, and maybe you're starting to think about work. And then you're starting to think about the conflicts of work. And then what are you going to do? And what's a threat to you at work? Or what you have to accomplish, there's a threat because you haven't finished this project you're supposed to have done by, you know, yesterday. You see the whole complexity of it. And you move along, you get in your car, you go to work, and whatever happened in that moment, even if it's the same routine every day, that experience is gone forever. It will never return, that particular experience. It's utterly and eternally gone, by lunch, you know what I mean? Or even by the time you shut the door and you got in your car. Like, so if you're sensitive to change, it's happening all the time. And the ego is sensitive to change. It doesn't want it. And it's trying to stay preoccupied and reinforced.
And is that why you're saying this continuity issue? It has to continually prop itself up.
Yes.
Because it's getting bombarded with things that are trying to show it that it's actually not that way. You're not this separate thing.
Right.
But you need to continue that. So you have to continue. While the world continues to affect you because you're not in any way separate from it, it has to continually demand its own separation and prop up its separation because it's being bombarded by the opposite.
Yeah, so it's always under attack by reality.
Yes, right.
Because not because reality is trying to harm you, but because you're out of whack with it, so it's always this gravitational pull against what you're trying to do. So therefore, in terms of feeling or sensation, there's an ongoing sense of insecurity and dissatisfaction. Like you haven't quite achieved the permanent freedom from pain and the permanent I-ness, me-ness that you're fundamentally habituated to pursuing. So, and on the basis of feeling that dissatisfaction, that insecurity, then we do all kinds of things all the way up to,
drop bombs.
Bombing another country into the Stone
drop
Age.
Bombs. Yeah, drop bombs on somebody. Yeah.
That's why you buy insurance, and it's why you...
Because none of it ever actually works. It kind of works. But you don't ever achieve the actual stability and peace of mind that you're looking for.
You can achieve pleasure. You can change things you don't like and so on. But since you're always externalizing that, the fundamental thing, which is internal, is never addressed.
which is what fundamental thing?
That your consciousness is wrapped up in maintaining its egocentrism.
Yes.
And that the suffering, or fundamental suffering, the existential suffering, arises from there. Yes, there's suffering that comes from your environment. Just like a few weeks ago, we had this very cold spell of, sub-zero weather, which we don't get much of here. And, it was pretty kind of tough for it to be that cold. So that's maybe an external problem, but the existent, the weather changes and it's warmer again, and so it's easier. But that's one thing, and we have to negotiate that. But the fundamental thing that's bothering us is not that.
Mm-hmm. And I fight this in therapy all the time, because you help people heal themselves from the deeper levels of suffering. And once, because I practice mindfulness-based cognitive behavior therapy, once people are mindful and start really paying attention, let alone start a meditation practice, yes, they are free of some of the more abject suffering. They won't meet criteria in the DSM-5 anymore. But none of them report true, stable peace of mind. They say that continues to be quite elusive. And then they start asking questions about that, like, okay, I'm not suffering the way I was, but I wouldn't call myself good now that I know what good might even be. Yeah. I just don't ever feel.
Yeah. You raised your standard suddenly.
right. Well, your mind and sometimes in meditation or something like that, if they start meditating, they might start getting glimpses. And especially if they're doing like the glimpse practices from like Locke Kelly or Stephen Bodian and others that are helping people get glimpses of what freedom might kind of be like. Now, sure, there's still plenty of ego in there and it's not all the way, but they're starting to get glimpses. And because the mind is so relative, once it starts to get glimpses of those other states, it starts to realize like my 9 out of 10 day, I didn't realize that the scale went to 1,000. I thought my 9 out of 10 day was pretty good. But now that I've had a glimpse of 100, I'm not real happy about my 10 anymore.
Yeah, one man's ceiling is another man's floor, right?
Right. But that's what's kind of cool is, and
But the other thing that happens too is also that your mind calms down. And then your suffering becomes more acute because now you're noticing.
Right. I've had people say this to me. Like, on some level, I wish I weren't so mindful. But then I always ask, would you go back? And they say no. There's some other things that come up.
You're stuck with, you can't develop knowledge without experiencing yourself in a more naked way, and that includes the suffering.
Yeah, but that's a very difficult moment for a lot of people because you're...
Yeah, me too.
you start to see it everywhere, and you see everyone is wrapped up in this thing, but you don't really yet have the skills and the capabilities and stability of those capabilities to really be okay with it. So there's this lull period that can last years. And when I was taught meditation and studied an awful lot of Buddhism, as you have, of course, I don't remember that ever being told to me. Like, hey, this stuff is going to be really great to learn, and it's going to help you, and it's going to get you on a path. But, it's like Trungpa Rinpoche said, like, if you're not going to go all the way to the end, you probably shouldn't start. Because once you start, you're going to start seeing this mess and you're not going to be able to unsee it. And then you're going to be, now you're really in the crap and you realize how even in your best moments, there was this fixation and grasping at, I don't want this moment to end. When can I get the next moment like this? And you're never really peaceful. That's not a state you've ever even had. And now you know it. but you don't know what to do with that. And that kind of, like, for lack of a better word, it sucks. That really sucks.